Okay, Hosea. Tonight, we're going to review fairly extensively the material that we saw last week having the remembrance, of course, and rehearsing these things more than once gives you a more solid foundation in the book itself. And so I thought what I'd do is design a sort of a little quiz here for you this evening. Go ahead and just sound out loud if you can. Question number one, who are the four contemporary 8th century B.C. prophets? Okay, that works, doesn't it? These are memory tricks that John and I learned going all the way back to Dale Carnegie classes. I guess, you know, you learn to remember things in that way. So they are Amos, Hosea, Isaiah, and Micah. So question number two, which two preached to the 10 northern tribes of Israel, also called Samaria and also called Ephraim? Which? Okay, you have Amos and Hosea. So the first two in our acronym, AHIM, I know that's clear in your voice, but A-H-I-M. Number three, which two preached to the two southern tribes of Judah, which are referred to, the tribes themselves are Judah and Benjamin. So it's not quite like it was with Israel where an alternate name is Samaria or Ephraim. Here those are the two tribes themselves. So what are the two prophets that are going to the southern part of Israel? Okay, those two guys are Isaiah and Micah. So, number four, who preached first of the list of four? Amos comes first, and then who preached last? Micah comes last, and so then, which two had the longest and overlapping simultaneous missions? They then become Hosea and Isaiah. So, what I've been pointing out the last several weeks is that in our acronym, A-H-I-M, AHIM, you know, what you've got is also not just the memory of what the letters represent, but the order in which they preached, and then in the center, you've got with Hosea and Isaiah, the two that preached in the north, and the two that preached the longest. So, Amos is on one end, Micah's on the other end, and then with the AHIM, the A-H is in the north, the I-M is in the south. So hopefully that A-H-I-M will remind you of more than just, you know, the initial letters. So Hosea and Isaiah had the longer careers apparently, and then those two were overlapping each other. Now then, at number seven, which kingdom was in the worst shape, Israel or Judah? Israel. Now, I didn't put this on, you know, but why is Israel in worse shape? How would you describe the shape they're in? Say again? Never had a good king, and they were wholly given over to what for their entire history? Idolatry. They were just purely idolatrous with all the immorality then that followed. So question number eight, what year was Israel then conquered? Because they never did right. When did they finally get their comeuppance? That is 722 B.C., a tremendously important date in biblical history, the end of the 10 northern tribes. And we saw this in Hosea already last week. Did the 10 northern tribes ever come back as a recognizable kingdom again? Never coming back. Judah, however, will. So last question here, what country conquered Israel? It's the Assyrians, and their bonus points if you know the name of the king. It's Sennacherib. Okay. He's the one, of course, that had all of his problems with the 185,000 soldiers being killed in a night. Okay, so what we're going to do then is we're going to go back to the chapters we looked at last week. And since the first chapter is rather short and sets the tone for everything, we do want to read that whole chapter again this evening just to make brief comments. Yes?
Lee reminded me that Eldon had his surgery tomorrow.
Oh, okay. So is that the first one or the second one?
I'm only
going to
get one. Sounds like
he's
going
to try to
do it all at once.
Oh, okay. So they're going to combine those two. And so do be remembering Eldon entering into what looks like a dual surgery, you know, for tomorrow on his legs, the infection they're trying to attack. Okay, so let's just start off with Hosea chapter 1 and verse 1. the word of the Lord which came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, during the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and during the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. When the Lord first spoke to Hosea, the Lord said to Hosea, go, take to yourself a wife of harlotry, have children of harlotry, for the land commits flagrant harlotry, forsaking the Lord. So he went to Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. Now, it's my conviction, at least, that it's not necessary that Gomer be a prostitute in a very carnal sense. It's possible, maybe she was. Others will suggest she wasn't when they married, but she became one afterwards. And in all cases, it's really speculation. It's the sense you derive when you read the very little information that we have right here. My personal view, what I lean, 60-40 to, is that we're getting a description of this harlotry the first two times the word is used, when in verse 2, for the third time that the word is used, it says, for the land commits flagrant harlotry, forsaking the Lord. And so it's kind of hard to believe that, he was forced to marry an actual prostitute, but she's probably, in my view, a child of her culture. She is a harlot in the sense of being an idolater. She's one of those unfaithful souls, and he takes her to wife. He has how many kids? Three kids. These three kids have what we would call prophetic names. And the first one I really didn't talk about last week, so let's look at verse 4 again. The Lord said to him, name him Jezreel, for yet a little while, and I'll punish the house of Jehu, which is based there, for the bloodshed of Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of the house of Israel. What I did not point out last week is that Jezreel has a twofold meaning. It means to scatter. Okay? Now, you would take that, rightly so, and it's used that way in a very negative sense. What is God going to do to this northern kingdom? He's going to scatter them to the winds, and they're never going to have an identifiable kingdom again. But when the sower went out to sow, what was he doing? He was scattering that seed, wasn't he? So it also has the meaning to sow. That is, to be scattering the seed because you're expecting a harvest, and in that sense, it's not negative at all. And the purpose of these children and of the relationships, I think, plural, that Hosea is involved in here, have to do with demonstrating, showing in the life of the man and the names of the children and all of that, the relationship that God has, not with just that one woman, and not with just Hosea, and not with their marriage, but with that marriage and that woman and Hosea representing what larger picture? God's view of the country, of the people. And in all three cases, as it starts off, the kids are named in a negative manner as a warning. So every time you hear their names, they're very unusual names. And these names remind the people of their sin, of their faithlessness. And with the first one, it says, yet a little while and I will punish the house of Jehu. So you call it scattering. Because I'm going to do what? Punish. That then means the idea here is scattering in a very negative sense, so you're disassembling something. And then, second child, verse 6, he conceived again, and she conceived again, and gave birth to a daughter, and the Lord said to him, name her Lo-Ruhamah. What does the Lo do in the Hebrew language? Lo is a negative. So in our language, if we want to say a negative and attach a prefix to the word, what word would we use? Non or un. Or we would use a separate word, we would say not. And so she conceived again, gave birth to a daughter. The Lord said to him, name her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have what? Ruhamah means compassion on the house of Israel, that I should ever forgive them. So, you can reach a point where what you've done is over and too late, and you're never going to be forgiven for what you've done. As a matter of fact, in 1 John, we are taught that people can get so far removed from the Lord that you should not what for them? Shouldn't even pray for them. That people can get so obviously messed up that when it comes to the gospel, you should not cast your pearls before them. They're unteachable. They're lost. They're gone. And so he's saying with Israel, this is the state they've gotten themselves into when the day of judgment, and therefore Jezreel, the scattering comes, it's entire and complete, they're never going to be reformed again. This is because I will no longer have compassion that I should ever forgive them.
Could it also be that the scattering is happening and the time to reap will come after the scattering? So that they're going to reap what is sown this time?
Carol's exactly right, and that is exactly what gets done in these illustrations and the purpose of the names. So yes, it starts off negative in all three cases, and then in all three cases, you have the undoing of that, the possibility of God receiving these people again. Now, by the way, and it's at this point that I can do it now, I hadn't thought to do this in my studies before, but I went through today, read the whole book, and then I used a blue highlighter. Every time a regional name is given, so that you can know in an instant, because I just got the blue highlight there, who it is that's being talked about. And so it was 14 chapters, and this time I was just kind of surprised because I had to get down and work with my highlighter before I realized how often it is that Hosea and Isaiah are referencing both the house of Israel and Judah. So look at verse 6. He conceived again, gave birth to a daughter, and the Lord said to him, name her Lo-Ruhamah, for I will no longer have compassion on the. So what did I highlight? House of Israel, I shall forgive them. But then what's it say in verse 7? I'll have compassion on the house of Judah and deliver them by the Lord their God. I will not deliver them by bow, sword, battle horses, or horsemen. So what country will eventually take over the two southern tribes? Babylon's going to take them into captivity. Will they come back as an identifiable, recognizable nation kingdom again? Yes, they will. There's going to be a degree of compassion for them that there is not for Israel. But it was interesting to me, and I noticed it here, you know, that next door to each other in verses 6 and 7, we've got house of Israel and house of Judah, and then that happens again and again and again and again. So while I've been saying, you know, that Hosea is a preacher in the north, and that he's preaching to the north. Well, he's in the north, so he has to be preaching to the north. But does that mean that he should be limited to prophecies about only the north? No. And there's a lot of Judah in Hosea. So and then finally, yeah, verse 8, when she weaned Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived and gave birth to a son. The Lord said, name him Lo-Ami, so not, you are not my people. Lo-Ami is not people. And therefore my people, God's people, I'm not your God. Yet, the number of the sons of Israel will be like sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. It'll come about that in the place where it is said to them, you're not my people, it will be said to them, you are the sons of the living God. So, what does verse 10, what function does it serve in the New Testament? You knew when you read it, you've read that before. It's in Romans chapter 9, verses 24 through 26. Now, I'm putting it up on the screen for you there. I'm breaking in the middle of a kind of a convoluted thought. But, you know, whom he also called, not from among the Jews only, but also from among the Gentiles. So we're talking about a calling of Jews and Gentiles in Hosea. That's what that verse means. We have an inspired interpretation. And that's all right. As he also says in Hosea, quote Bullen down here, I will call those who were not my people, and her who was not beloved, my beloved. Well, that's just verbatim, isn't it, from Hosea? And so, this statement identifying Hosea is among the very easiest in Scripture to recognize. We find it in Hosea, we find it in Romans, the two are identical in their use, and we're told what it refers to. God is calling the Jews and the Gentiles. So the number of the sons of Israel will be like the sand of the sea. Is this a prophecy about the 10 northern tribes, usually referred to as Israel, going off into their captivity and destruction at the hands of Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, and then they're all going to come back again, huge numbers? No, not physically. But this word Israel, in this case, probably has been expanded to include what was before all the civil war broke out in 930 AD with the death of Solomon, 930 BC, with the death of Solomon. Israel referred to what? How many tribes? It was all 12 for the longest time. So when you think about that, these descendants of these tribes, that is Jewish people, that is the chosen people, the people of God, and not just in a physical sense, but in a spiritual sense, will embrace both Jew and Gentile and be vastly larger than the Jews ever were. So the chapter ends, and the sons of Judah and the sons of Israel will be gathered together, and they will appoint for themselves one leader. They'll go up from the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. What does Jezreel mean? Scattering or sowing. So there you are, Carol. You know, we come back full circle, only now we are also changing from physical circumstances to a new covenant, spiritual covenant, and that leader is unquestionably Jesus the Christ. So, now we come to Hosea chapter 2, and again, we're just, you know, doing an overview survey of the book, and so not going to get into any kind of detail at all, but I'm going to skip all the way down to verses 6, 7, and 8 to even start the chapter. So in chapter 2, verse 6, therefore, behold, I will hedge up her way with thorns. I will build a wall against her so that she cannot find her paths. She will pursue her lovers, but she will not overtake them. She will seek them, but will not find them. Then she'll say, I'll go back to my first husband, for it was better for me then than now. For she does not know that it was I who gave her the grain, the new wine, and the oil, and lavished on her silver and gold, which they used for Baal. And then it goes on like that, down essentially to the end of the chapter. So, this woman that Hosea married is representative of a faithless people. And then this word harlotry, this is another thing I did today. I went through, and I'm just going to count again, and went through the whole book. Find every use of harlot or harlots or harlotry. And, you know, I was surprised. I knew it was a lot, but it's 20 times in 14 chapters that word is used. It's used mostly in the early going, in the first half of the book. And so it's even more concentrated. It's almost, you know, 2 to 1, if you will, 20 to 10 chapters, even less than that. And so it's chapters-wise. It's just all about harlotry, this book. But the harlotry that we're talking about, now as you skip down to verses 13 and following, has to do with their faithlessness. They are worshiping Baal, as we just read, and not realizing God gives them all good things. So when you go to verse 13, I will punish her for the days of the Baals, when she used to offer sacrifices to them and adorn herself with her earrings and jewelry and follow her lovers so that she forgot me, declares the Lord. So for all that goes on between Hosea and his wife, however you conceive of that, the harlotry that we're most concerned about is that of the nation because they've taken a new lover. Who's the new lover? Baal. Which, of course, famous idol that has plagued them for a long time in their history. Now, 19 to 20. And I will betroth you to me forever. Yes, I'll betroth you to me in righteousness and in justice and loving kindness and in compassion, and will betroth you to me in faithfulness. Then you will know Yahweh. So again, as Carol pointed out a moment ago, there's a great deal of balance and mercy and compassion in the book. You get the warnings, you get the threats, you get the prophetic names on the children, you get all of these physical activities representing something much larger. And in that, there is a time coming, not for the immediate physical people, but there's a time coming when Judah, the house of Judah and the house of Israel will be joined together. They'll have one Lord, and that is all prophetic of Jesus the Christ. And when this happens, brethren, betrothed forever in verse 19, betrothed in righteousness, justice, loving kindness, compassion, and then in verse 20, faithfulness, and you'll know, you will know the Lord. More on that in just a second. So, will they certainly be punished for their sins? There's no way they're going to turn back. This is inevitable now. Why does God punish people for their sins? That's the answer I'm looking for. It's not because he just is mad. It's not because he just feels slighted and now wants to do damage, you know, out of some sense of just base, you know, unhappiness. It's not that at all. And so people who teach, you know, the God of the Old Testament is so vindictive and destructive and all this, and that's God, and I want no part of him. You hear all these excuses all the time. You know, just demonstrate their own ignorance. This was all done as it should be done by any compassionate, kind, faithful, just, and righteous parent for correction, for instruction in righteousness, to call back. It's not just an angry God losing his temper. Is an extremely wise and disciplined and careful God who in prudence distributes these punishments for the purpose of trying to win these people back. So sure, they're going to be punished. You can't escape it. If you're faithful like God is, either physically with your children or in God's case here, but all for the sake of trying to call the people back. Now you see chapter 3 really tiny, so 5 verses, so let's read the whole thing. Yahweh said to me, go again, love a woman who is loved by her husband, yet an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes. Now, last week I just chose to present that in one manner. It's only fair that I let you know that most people think this is Gomer, or many of the commentators would suggest that this is the same woman. It's hard for me to see that. The description is very different, and then, you know, who's he buying her from? Bought for myself 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley would be the cost of a woman that he already is married to. Who would you pay, and why? It doesn't add up for me. I'm not alone in this view, but you know, I just didn't mention it. It is important to recognize that maybe this is Gomer, and perhaps that's the case, and if it is, then that would be quite a picture, you know, of forgiveness and compassion and bring her back. He's, you know, going to try again despite all the horror of the way she's behaved toward Hosea. But again, in 3:1, Yahweh said to me, go again. Well, I want you to do a second thing and not again to repeat what you've already done, but love a woman who is loved by her husband. Well, it could be Hosea, but it's an odd way to say it. And, you know, how hard would it be to take her back if you love her? Yet an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes, which is idolatrous worship. So I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and a homer and a half of barley, some pronounce that omer. And then I said to her, you shall stay with me for many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. So I will also be toward you. For the sons of Israel will remain for many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or household idols. Afterward, the sons of Israel will return and seek Yahweh their God and David their king, and they will come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days. So you have to decide. That's all the information we have. Is it the same woman from chapter 1? Possibly. But there's enough, you know, question there that in my own view, I don't think that's the case. And yet, ultimately, we have these circumstances where, again, it is emblematic of something else. And fortunately, again, in verse 5, after we're done with the unhappiness, what happens in verse 5? Afterward, the sons of Israel will return, seek the Lord, David their king, you know, it's all good. In the what? In the last days. Now, brother, I'm here to suggest tonight, and I've done this before myself, I've heard this from other teachers. When most people today see the two words last and days put together, what do they immediately think of?
you know, the end of the whole planet, the end of the entire universe, final judgment, you know, and this is just the way our culture has been led to believe. I listened to a teacher again this week who said he had searched stem to stern and could not find a single use of the term last days in Scripture that was talking about that. He thought, as I do, that when you're talking about these last days in the Old Testament or in the New, you're talking about the last days contextually of what? Moses' law, the Old Covenant, the special favored nation status of the Jews. The end that you're talking of is the last days of that old system, because all of these passages speak of the last days of that in the great hope that we can get the first days of what? Christianity, the fulfillment of the Old Testament's symbols and figures. So I'll just leave that for you to chew on from now on. Whenever you see that term, last days or latter days, you know, ask yourself, end of what? What's the last of what? And in the context, it's not the planet, it's not the entire universe. It is this covenant that these people are currently violating. Now, so, necessarily, Gomer, all right. So, but what's the main point of the chapter in chapter 3? Ultimately, does it end up well in the last days? That's great. It's going to be okay. Yes?
The verse 2, so I bought her for myself for 15 shekels. It seems to me that God is describing that this woman, that Israel, is being sold into slavery. Judith sold into slavery, but he's going to buy her back.
Well, the vision is a payment to get back. I mean, that's true. And Hosea apparently paid this actual amount of money. Don't forget the barley. And so, but you're right. That's the image. The image is, I will pay a price to get her back. And ultimately, in these last days, what is the price that's paid to have now spiritual Israel back? It's Christ himself that is the Redeemer. Okay, so we're going to move on to chapter 4 and look at the first three verses of chapter 4. Listen to the word of Yahweh, O sons of Israel. I highlighted in blue, sons of Israel. I know specifically who he's addressing this to. For Yahweh has a case against the inhabitants of the land because there is no faithfulness or kindness or knowledge of God in the land. There are three things that we lack. We have no faithfulness, we have no kindness, and we have no knowledge of God in that land. There is swearing, deception, murder, stealing, and adultery. They employ violence so that bloodshed follows bloodshed. Therefore the land mourns, and everyone who lives in it languishes, along with the beasts of the field and the birds of the sky and also the fish of the sea disappear. Again, God punishing, and every time, because there's no faithfulness, kindness, or knowledge, and there is this whole list of sins, then when, you know, these animals disappear, the people are suffering, they need them, they use them, food, clothing, milk, you know, and then they're gone. We learn our lesson, hopefully. Now, as you can see on the screen, skip back to verse 6, or down to verse 6. My people are destroyed for what? Well, there was no knowledge of God in the land in verse 1. Now, my people are destroyed for that reason. This is the why. Because you've rejected knowledge. I also will reject you from being my priest, since you have forgotten the law of your God. I also will forget your children. So, we don't have any faithfulness. Now, by the way, faithfulness means that there's something toward which you are what? Being faithful. So that involves the proper knowledge of God in and of itself. And then we also don't have kindness, and then the long list of unkind things that they're doing. But in verse 6, it's the same idea, destroyed for lack of knowledge. You've rejected knowledge. You've forgotten the law of your God. Now again, looking at the screen, I skip on down to verse 14 then. I will not punish your daughters when they play the harlot, or your brides when they commit adultery, for the men themselves go apart with harlots and offer sacrifices with temple prostitutes. So the people without what are ruined? Without understanding means they're without what? Knowledge. Again, they went out without their gods, but again, they don't understand. Their ignorance is what's at stake here. So I actually ran out of time. We ran out of town too, I guess, this week, but out of time last week. And so I just wanted you to see that in chapter 4 three times. The problem is their lack of knowledge. It's in verse 1, it's in verse 6, it's in verse 14. What is Hosea's job? To put an end to ignorance. Now, by the way, brethren, once you know the truth, bad enough if you don't, and you're false if you don't. Please always remember that. If people are charged, then they're guilty. It's not that God didn't send prophets. It's not that they didn't have, you know, the Old Testament. It's not that they couldn't have found it if they wanted to. This lack of knowledge is culpable. They didn't see him. They didn't want it. They therefore had this terrible ignorance. But this is the reason why all else follows into the immorality and then their destruction. Is that any less true today? And I would suggest no. United States is never named in Scripture, doesn't have anything to do with any direct biblical prophecies whatsoever, no matter what premillennialism might maintain. You know, and the United States is never, you know, directly spoken of in Scripture. But we do have Scriptures like Genesis 15, which say that the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full, and in its context, because the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full, then it's not time for the Jews to move into their land. It's not time to occupy the promised land. When the iniquity of the Amorite is full, what's God going to do to the Amorite? Annihilate them and replace them with another people. That's a broad general principle, I think, in God's dealings with all nations and down to this day. And so, this nation suffers from the general principle of a lack of knowledge. Now, by the way, usually, I don't know, I suppose there can be exceptions and all, but look, does a nation become immoral first and then they forget God? It's the other way around. This ignorance is the source of all the problems. And so this nation has become astonishingly ignorant of Scripture. It's just amazing. I told you I met a man one day, and my jaw just dropped. I made the comment that such and such, I don't even know what the topic was. I said, I suppose it's been going on since Adam and Eve. And he turned to me and he said, who are they? Never had he ever heard of Adam and Eve. So if I was going to get off track tonight, you know, and just kind of go preach, you know, a personal kind of thing, brethren, if I have to select one problem that's wrong with America, is it Congress? Is it the president? Is it the police force? You know, what's wrong with America? It is the dereliction of parental responsibility. Parents don't raise their children to know God. And because we now have gotten generation after generation farther and farther away from any kind of teaching, it is all but totally illegal now. It's been cast out of schools, been cast out everywhere. A nation was founded on that book in every conceivable sense. Founded on that book. They came here because they were persecuted. They set up a government that was made in the image of their understanding of Scripture. Now, all of our government is founded on biblical principles. And look, you know, the force in the world history that we became. And then we have watched at an accelerating pace, I believe, in our lifetime, you know, the complete turning of our backs in this land upon our God. And as a result, brethren, everything is at risk, as Isaiah is teaching, specifically to these people, and we learn the general principles ourselves. So, brethren, I don't put my hope in Congress. I don't put my hope in, you know, presidents. I don't put my hope in wise laws and all that kind of stuff. It's you and I meeting our friends and neighbors and teaching them about the knowledge of God in this land that will preserve this land, and nothing else will. And it is convincing young adults to inform their children about God if this nation is to survive, or absolutely any other. So why do they sin, and why are they punished in chapter 4? Ignorance. And that results in the immorality and the inevitable punishment. Now, that's where we're going to stop with the slides tonight. And tonight I just want to add chapters 5, 6, and 7 to our discussion. And then next week we'll take chapters 8 through 14. We'll finish the entire book next week. So chapter 5 reads like this. Hear this, O priests. Give heed, O house of Israel. Listen, O house of the king. For the judgment applies to you. You have been a snare at Mizpah and a net spread out on Tabor. And the revolters have gone deep in depravity, but I will chastise all of them. I know Ephraim and Israel, this is one of the same, is not hidden from me. For now, O Ephraim, you have played the harlot. Israel has defiled itself. Their deeds will not allow them to return to their God, for a spirit of harlotry is within them, and they do not know the Lord. There's that ignorance for Orthon. Moreover, the pride of Israel testifies against it. And Israel and Ephraim stumble in their iniquity. Judah also has stumbled with them. See how he keeps just kind of slipping Judah in there next to Israel. Their time will come, but not for one. They'll go with their flocks and herds to seek the Lord, but they'll not find him. He has withdrawn from them. They've dealt treacherously against their Lord, for they have borne illegitimate children. Now the new moon will devour them with their land. Blow the horn at Gibeah, the trumpet in Ramah, sound the alarm at Beth-Aven. Behind you, Benjamin, Ephraim will become a desolation in the day of rebuke. Among the tribes of Israel, I declare what is sure, the princes of Judah have become like those who move a boundary. On them I will pour out my wrath like water. Ephraim, is oppressed, crushed in judgment because he was determined to follow command. Now, they've inserted man's. It's in italics. It isn't in the original text. But the idea is they're not standing up to be leaders who are teaching about their God. And they're just bowing to whatever the whims of the time. Saw last week, you know, like people, like priests. So they're just determined to follow, you know, these worthless rulers and leaders, and that's why they'll be oppressed and crushed. So in 12, therefore, I am like a moth to Ephraim and like rottenness to the house of Judah. Now, in both cases, what is that a picture of? Moths and rottenness. It is corruption from within. A moth comes and chews out all the holes, and then now you have no integrity, no usefulness. In the rottenness, the same thing. You have the natural integrity of the thing that is rotting away, eaten away, and so now, you know, it has no use. God's going to be like that. But in both of those cases, is that an instantaneous thing? No, you see the slow degradation, the slow descent into depravity, and perfectly synchronized with it, the increasing weakness of the nation to its destruction. And so, 13, when Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah his wound, then Ephraim went to Assyria and said to King Jareb, he is unable to heal you or to cure you of your wound. I will be like a lion to Ephraim and like a young lion to the house of Judah. See how they keep putting them both together? They're together in verse 12, in verse 10, now in verse 14. I'm going to be like a lion to both. I will tear to pieces and go away. I'll carry away and there'll be none to deliver. I'll go away and return to my place until they acknowledge their guilt and seek my face. In their affliction, they will earnestly seek me. Now, by the way, was that true physically for Israel? Sure, it worked great. When they were taken off into captivity, they recognized that God was punishing them. They knew that they could not be conquered if God was on their side. So if we are conquered, who has abandoned us? Our God. But they would learn and understand. That's not to blame God. He's not a negligent, you know, parent. He left us because we asked for it. So if we'll turn back to him, he'll return. This is, you know, the whole point. We have the word harlotry used twice again in this chapter and about in verse 1, Mizpah and Tabor, or in verse 8, Gibeah, Ramah, Beth-Aven, you know, and behind you, Benjamin. It doesn't matter that you know where these places are. I'm not putting up pictures, you know, and maps and all that at this time. Why is he using these names? It's to say, who's going to escape? Nobody. It's everywhere. It's from here to there. It's from east to west. It's from north to south. There's no place you can go that isn't corrupt or won't be taken down. So chapter 5, pretty grim. Harlotry, harlotry. You know, the princes are this way. The king is this way. You know, everybody's this way in the whole land. And so, you're going down. So that, in verse 15, you'll earnestly seek me. Now, chapter 6. Come, let us return to Yahweh, for he has torn us. Torn us like what? Lions. But he will heal us. He has wounded us, but he will bandage us. He will revive us after 2 days. He'll raise us up on the third day that we may live before him. Now, I don't think those are literal days, obviously. It's like a 3 transgressions or 4 that you have in Amos. You know, it's a figurative expression. But by the way, you know, we have prophecies about Jesus rising from the dead. It is more than, you know, at least coincidental in verse 6, that who is raised up on the third day? And we will live before him eternally. So in verse 3, let us know, let us press on to know the Lord. His going forth is as certain as the dawn. He will come to us like the rain, like the spring rain watering the earth. What shall I do with you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O? See how often the two are mentioned. For your loyalty is like a morning cloud and like the dew which goes away early. Now, as it so happens, you know, the main windows of our house face east. We have a lawn, like most people do in the front of their house. This morning, I looked out the window, and what was sunrise like this morning? Oh, it was fabulous, not a cloud in the sky. And so as the first light of dawn was coming over the trees, you know, they're over there across the street, what do I see all over my grass? Yeah, what does this look like? Look like field of diamonds. Every blade had a little diamond on the top. And the sun was just, you know, igniting them all, just lighting them up. And I just stood there for a moment. Look how beautiful it is. This is grass. Each one's got one single drop of water up on the top. And now the way that sun is, it just, you couldn't possibly make my lawn just sparkle and shine. Okay? I looked at my thermometer. It was 47 degrees. About an hour later, it was 57 degrees. And I looked at my lawn. Now what? What happened to all that water? At that moment, it was so beautiful. And it was a lot of water. Nourishing, replenishing, life-giving. But an hour later, what? And that's how faithful Israel and Judah have become. What an awful picture. You know, it's just a heartbreaking picture. Your loyalty is like a morning cloud and the dew which goes away early. Therefore, I've hewn them in pieces by the prophets. Well, there's something for you to think about. What is a prophet? What is a mouthpiece for God? What do prophets do? He tells the people how to behave and the consequences if they don't. It foretells the future, you know, both for them and for a coming great king. All true. But in verse 5 it says he did what by the prophets? What is the image of being hewn in pieces? It's ugly, isn't it? It's way ugly. to be hewn in pieces is to see a soldier coming through with his sword, using it like a scythe to just cut every person into pieces as he walks through. Just limbs flying in every direction with the attendant blood. This is the work of a prophet. Okay? Verbally, they can get pretty harsh, can't they? Yes, and they do. We've studied places where they do, and there's some of that right here, to say the least. I've hewn them in pieces by the prophets. I've slain them by the words of my mouth. And the judgments on you are like the light that goes forth. For I delight in loyalty rather than sacrifice, and in the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. But like Adam, they have transgressed the covenant. There they have dealt treacherously against me. Gilead, a city of wrongdoers, tracked with bloody footprints, and as raiders wait for a man, so a band of priests murder on the way to Shechem. And here we go again with all these places. Gilead's over in the east. Shechem is, you know, in the center of what we would call Samaria in New Testament times, but the heart of this Israel kingdom. Band of priests murder on the way to Shechem. Surely they have committed crime. In the house of Israel, I've seen a horrible thing. Ephraim's harlotry is there. Israel has defiled itself. Also, O Judah, there's a harvest appointed for you when I restore the fortunes of my people. Okay? So, that's hopeful, but it's also in warning. So, Judah's going to see all this go down. Judah's going to see that there's no response to these prophets, but will Judah still have over 130 years of good kings, mostly? Yeah, better, more faithful people. Sure it is. But is it surely coming? It is. So in 7, when I would heal Israel, the iniquity of Ephraim is uncovered, and the evil deeds of Samaria. For they deal falsely. The thief enters in, bandits raid outside, and they do not consider in their hearts that I remember all their wickedness. Now their deeds are all around them. They are before my face. With their wickedness they make the king glad, and the princes with their lies. Brother, every so often, thanks to, you know, recent and modern technologies, do people get caught on camera, caught, you know, on tape recordings? You know, we've only had recordings going on since World War II. It's not very long. How many times, you know, something goes public, and then when that mask comes off, isn't it sometimes just so stunning? Okay? Now, not that it had to do with you know, recordings, but aren't you just reeling over Bill Cosby? I mean, that's unfamily. That hurts. You know, that guy was America's dad for the longest time. I couldn't wait to watch the show, you know, and have the kids watch it and all of that. You know, and the principles that he taught, you know, and just forming a whole generation. You know, there may be hope for America yet. And behind the scenes, what was it all about? Guy was just as rotten and corrupt as anything could get. And now he's going off to jail, you know, what is he, almost 80, I forget. And, you know, it's just unbelievable. Okay? But my point is, brethren, that back behind the scenes, people get caught all the time, you find out what they really are. And this says, wickedness makes the king glad. How corrupt is that government? And the princes, it says, the idea is make glad with lies. They're rejoicing in lies. And while that is appalling to us, brethren, how many people really do take pride in getting away with a good lie? They think it's a sign of how smart they are. Loads of people do that. All the while singing praise, you know, to the truth and honor and all of that. But, you know, are we so far removed from any of this? Don't seem to be, if any of these recordings that keep coming lying, it don't mean anything. Verse 4 says they're all adulterers. Like an oven heated by the baker who ceases to stir up the fire from the kneading of the dough until it is leavened. On the day of our king, the princes became sick with the heat of wine. He stretched out his hand with stoppage for their hearts, and it continues with this figure, are like an oven as they approach their plotting. Their anger smolders all night. In the morning it burns like a flaming fire. All of them are hot like an oven, and they consume their rulers. All their kings have fallen. None of them calls on me. Well, the kings go down because they delight in all of this unrighteousness. But, you know, it's harder for us maybe to relate to this. When you want to prepare for cooking, what do? Well, before you leave for work in the morning, you set the timer to turn the oven on, so when you get home, it's all ready for you. Okay? In those days, what did you have to do to prepare to cook? You had to seriously go out, gather the wood, build the fire. You have to maintain the fire so it doesn't go out, you know, and you've got all this activity, and now you've got your oven, and it's properly heated. When you get it just right, then you've got to knead the dough, and you put it inside. You know, there's a real serious involved operation there, and everything has to be just right if it's going to come out just right. So what are these guys like? They're all like the oven. Okay? So what comes out of their oven that they've been working on so carefully and skillfully for so long? Lies and every form of abominable kind of sin. So, in 7, all of them are like hot ovens. They consume their rulers, all their kings have fallen, and none of them calls on me. Ephraim mixes himself with the nations. Ephraim has become a cake not turned. Now, brethren, everybody loves it. I've never heard a class yet. You know, I've heard it dozens of times. People go with verse 8 and they say, oh, he's half-baked. Ah. You know, and that's okay. I mean, I guess it's okay. But, you know, it really kind of doesn't work. When we say the thing is half-baked, what do we really mean? Well, all sides were being heated, but what happened? It stopped before, you know, it's fully done. That's not the image here. What happens if you have a griddle and you put the cake down and you never turn it? Yeah, that's not half-baked. What is that? That's just burnt up, you know. That's, you know, it's completely ruined in that manner, and it's really a different thing. So I don't think that's it. It's not the idea of half-baked because I need to cook the other side. It is that it just got left until it's just burnt up. Strangers devour his strength, you know, not halfway, yet he does not know. Gray hairs also are sprinkled on him, yet he does not know. Though the pride of Israel testifies against him, yet they have neither returned to the Lord their God, nor they sought him for all this. So Ephraim has become like a silly dove without sense. They call it Egypt. They go to Assyria. When they go, I will spread my net over them. I'll bring them down like the birds of the sky. I'll chastise them in accordance with the proclamation of their assembly. Woe to them, for they have strayed from me. Destruction is theirs, for they've rebelled against me. I would redeem them, but they speak lies against me, and they do not cry to me from their heart when they wail on their beds. For the sake of grain and new wine, they assemble themselves. The idea is, but they turn away from me. Although I train them, strengthen their arms, yet they devise evil against me. They turn, but not upward. They're like a deceitful bow. Their princes will fall by the sword because of the insolence of their tongue. They will be their derision in the land of Egypt. Now, brother, in my view, Egypt comes up a whole lot in this book. This is another thing I didn't touch on. I made a note at chapter 2 and in verse 15. It says, as in the day when she came up from the land of Egypt. Egypt is mentioned in Hosea in chapter 2, 7, 8, 9, 11, 12, and 13, in many of those chapters in more than one verse. And it's all about helping these people to understand, was Egypt ever a good thing? Well, it was as long as Joseph died. Okay. But as soon as Joseph died, you know, in slavery, captivity, and they had to come out of Egypt. Should they be making alliances with Egypt? No. And in this book, you not only don't look for your help from Egypt, but also, when he uses it as a figure, you're going back to Egypt. Not physically. They're not going back into an Egyptian captivity. But brethren, if I say to you, you know, the thus and such is going on between countries and everything, and it looks like we're going back to Vietnam now, what do I mean? Mired in an endless, you know, an useless loss of life, ultimately, is what I mean. So this particular use of Egypt, though, you know, is God just so disappointed? They know they need help. Do they turn to God? What do they turn to? Egypt, Syria, Baal, everywhere but to God. And sure enough, it's like looking at the headlines in our country, isn't it? It is. It's distressing. It's fearsome. Yeah, fine. Does that change our mission?